Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author and former strategist, and each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello, and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink. I'm Anna Donaghy, and today's guest is someone I have genuinely been looking forward to sitting down with. Dr. Sarah Michaud is a clinical psychologist who has spent, I'm going to say over 30 years, it might be nearly 40 years, working in the field of addiction and codependency. She is the author of One Psychologist's Recovery from Codependency and Addiction, a memoir and manual for freedom. And she has been sober herself for, again, this is approximate 40 years, over 40 years. She co-hosts a YouTube channel called Leaving Crazy Town with her best friend, Finn, where they talk all things recovery. It is brilliant. And by all accounts, they do obviously have a lot of laughs along the way. I want to have a few laughs for today. What I really like about Sarah's story is it doesn't follow the neat arc that we're sometimes, you know, used to hearing or told to expect. She didn't get sober and live happily ever after. She got sober and then discovered that there was some real work to be done. And I think that's a truth that lots of people will probably benefit from hearing. So, without much ado, Sarah, welcome to the show. I am so glad that you're here.
It's so great to be here. It's so great to have conversations with interesting, thoughtful people about recovery and codependency, and not just about drinking and not drinking, because it's about a lot of other things.
It is, which we're going to talk about today, because there's so much else that goes on. And I do, you know, I do recommend that anyone who's listening who wants to listen to what a lot of those other things are, do listen to Leaving Crazy Town, because it's brilliant. You cover so much stuff on there. I mean, we're going to scratch the surface today.
Yeah.
But I want to start with your story, because I think it's the most powerful way into this conversation. You've been over 40 years, is it?
Yeah, I just celebrated 42 years. I got sober when I was 24.
That is extraordinary. That's brilliant. Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you. I mean, and I think we talked about this before. It really was the drugs, because I probably could have drank for a lot longer, but I started dabbling in cocaine. And then because you're dabbling in drugs, it costs money. And then the legal system. I do think, because of my lifestyle back then, I definitely crashed and burned after 8 years of using. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, you've been very open about the fact that you crashed and burned and then you went into recovery, but that certainly didn't solve everything. And in fact, I think you went back into treatment.
Yes.
About 10 years sober. So, tell us about it. I mean, take us back to that time and what was actually going on for you.
Well, it's interesting, Anna, because I was thinking about this question earlier today, and I think it also started before then, meaning I got sober in 1984, and I loved the hope of recovery. I mean, I felt better. I started working a job. You know, my life started to get better. I started to feel better. I made friendships. So all that was happening, but at about a year sober, I got bored. And I thought, I had that feeling like other people, is this all there is? And I started this journey of workshops, seminars, therapy. I mean, I joke that I did every New Age workshop known to man in the United States. I mean, there was the S training, there was the Insight seminars, I did ropes courses. I mean, I was a seeker. But the underlying thing is, I didn't feel at peace just in my body. So really, I was still seeking for the answer. And really, the answer is inside and figuring out kind of what was driving me, what was I running from, what was I trying not to feel. I was in a series of relationships. I mean, I felt like I was, and people often say this, I felt like I was a teenager. And I was reliving those teenage years that I really never got to experience. I started dating. I was, you know, all this stuff started to happen. I had had a weight issue as a kid and I lost a bunch of weight. So suddenly I'm like thinner and men are interested and I'm getting into this series of unsuccessful relationships. And then, so just to say, I ended up in graduate school in California and getting a doctorate degree, but I still had this pattern of wondering why I kept getting into the same situations over and over again. And, you know, I do believe...
What kind of situations?
Meaning relationships, sexual acting out, trying to find my my identity in a man or a relationship, thinking just the next boyfriend, I'll feel okay. The next thing, I'll be okay. Right. The next degree, the next job, you know, basically looking outside of myself for the answer.
Yeah. So this is, as you say, this is like seeking, seeking, seeking. And it wasn't just like seeking in terms of programs and information and insight.
It was both.
You were not, it was everything. Okay.
You're absolutely right. On one hand, I was seeking kind of recovery and trying to find solutions. And on the other hand, you know, a friend of mine often says we are relief-seeking missiles. And I was a relief-seeking missile. I was trying to find relief anywhere. And yet the irony is, I didn't really even know I was distressed. I mean, that's kind of the weird part of it. Is I'm seeking these things, but it's not like I'm conscious of being in pain. And I think that is part of addiction recovery also, where we get busy and we start distracting ourselves. You know, I ended up going back to college and getting degrees and all that stuff and relationships and just busyness. And even though I was in therapy, I wasn't really stopping long enough to really identify what was going on for me. So like you just said, I ended up going to treatment at 10 years sober to try to figure out what was going on.
So what had you got your degree in at this point? What were your studies all leading up to?
I had gotten a bachelor's degree in psychology, and then I was on my way to get a doctorate in psychology. I was becoming a clinical psychologist.
So you're training in the field. And at
training
the same time,
in the field.
Yes. At the same time, you've got your own stuff going on.
Absolutely.
So what was the thing for you at that time, Sarah, when you made that decision to go into treatment again? What was the moment where you just thought, oh, I can't do this anymore? And what were you hoping to find?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, not funny, but this is what I remember. So I moved to San Diego, California to go to graduate school. And I went to treatment after my first year. So the summer between my first and second year. And I remember being in this class about training to be a therapist. And the teacher said, does anybody want to volunteer? And I volunteered to be the patient. And he said, you know, you can say what's really happening in your life or what's not happening. You know, you can make something up. So the therapist started asking me questions. And I started talking about a guy that I had met in AA, and he had just gotten out of prison. I started to describe this man to the person in my class. Meanwhile, tattoos, you know, head to toe. He was a bodybuilder. I mean, when I was in that class describing this man, I remember the class got really quiet because people were just like, what is she doing? Just like, what is this woman doing? First of all, they didn't know I was in recovery. And so I'm talking about being in AA. I'm talking about being, you know, dating this guy that just got out of being in prison for 10 years. And I remember the professor at the end of that class said, you know, sometimes when people are in a program like this and they are under a lot of stress, they need other things as distractions and escapes. And basically he was telling me like, wow, you know, you may need to get into some real therapy because obviously this guy is not someone that you would want to be with. But for some reason, this was exciting to me or thrilling to me, or I don't know what it was at the time, but I did recognize, wow, what's wrong with me? Why can't I seem to be with kind of normal people? And why am I acting out when I'm getting a PhD in psychology? I mean, so I do remember the professor kind of giving me a little talk at the end and me questioning my behavior. And so that was kind of the beginning. And then I heard about this program in Quebec and I went up there and it was pretty much, it was not for people, like I hadn't relapsed. It wasn't about that. It was really for what they called the underlying causes and conditions. So it was to look at codependency. It was to look at kind of your childhood and what paradigms were you still living out of as an adult that weren't serving you. Yeah. And they did some fourth step work there. And so, I mean, it was a lot of kind of you'd be on the hot seat. And I remember being in this group where you're kind of in front of the room and they're barraging you with all these kind of questions. And what do you think about this? And, you know, your father did this. And so it was kind of a lot of insight. I mean, I do remember having a lot of insight, but I don't remember necessarily a big behavior change when I got there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I do. And I just want to, I want to double back on something you've just mentioned because you used the term codependency.
Yes.
Now, I think that's a term which I understand. I think I do.
Right.
I think it's probably one of those terms that, you know, people have heard and maybe never quite understood. Before we go any further, can we just look at that a minute?
Yes. I mean,
if somebody's never really understood it, how would you describe it, Sarah?
Yes, I have a few definitions. I mean, there are hundreds of definitions, and my original definition has changed over the years. So in the past, it was, I mean, just to give a tiny bit of history, you know, back in the 50s or 40s when Bill W. created AA, his wife Lois created an alternate program, Al-Anon. They really didn't necessarily use the word codependency. I'm not sure if they did or not, but it was all for the wives of the male alcoholics. So back when it began, it was this idea that someone is way more focused on someone else's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and they're focused on trying to fix, save, or change them. So I'm married to an alcoholic. I can't tolerate it. And I have this belief, if I fix you, I'm going to be okay. We're going to be okay, which is really the delusion of codependency. So originally back, and then all these books came out, you know, Jonathan Bradshaw, The Family, Claudia Black came out, Melody Beattie, Codependent No More, a famous book. And the beginning of all that codependency work was around someone who was dating or married to someone with a substance abuse problem. Mm-hmm. And over the years, now it's generalized. I think it can be anybody. A lot of parents are codependent with their children, and I can give you examples of that. I can be codependent with my boyfriend, even though he's not an active addict. So I can be more focused on his happiness, his well-being, rather than starting from here. So I wrote another definition this morning because it's really the inability to be who you are in a relationship because you live in the fear of what the other person is going to think or say or do.
Okay, that's the key, isn't it? It's the fear. Because I was going to say, you know, some people could be listening to this thinking, caring about what other people feel, caring about what other people feel and you know, how they are and stuff is nice. That's kind. It's a good, you know, it's a good thing to care.
Right.
But what you're saying is it is, and I think you used this term when we first met,
yeah,
this idea of dismissing the self.
Myself.
Yeah, dismissing yourself and hyper-focusing on another person.
Yeah, what they think. I mean, I can give you just kind of on a spectrum. So, and most people will relate to this. So say you're out with a couple of friends or you're out on a new date and they say to you, where would you like to eat? And you love Italian food, but you say, what would you like? Right? And they say, oh, I love Chinese. And you think to yourself, I don't like Chinese food, but I guess it'll be okay because it's our first date, right? Now, that's a small example, but you're basically denying, like, why would someone do that? So you're setting up a relationship in a lie. And again, this happens all the time. Someone will be preoccupied with, are they going to like me? And I'm not going to admit that I want Italian food because, oh, that might be pushy or bossy or whatever. When really, all you're doing is expressing a need. And the other really interesting thing here, Anna, is I'm not believing that if that person doesn't like Italian food, they won't say it. So I'm actually caretaking the other person because I don't believe they can speak up for themselves. I mean, that's intense. It's a small, tiny example, but I'm projecting already that I'm responsible for their feelings, which is crazy when you think about it.
And that's a key distinction, isn't it? Between, I mean, because there are a lot of people pleasers in life, a lot of people who will maybe relegate their own feelings, prioritize other people's feelings.
Yes.
But that thing that you just said there about caretaking other people's feelings, speaking on behalf of the other person
before
even had a chance. That I think that's a key. So why do you think this shows up specifically in people who've had difficult relationships with alcohol? Is there something about drinking per se that creates it or reveals it or both?
Well, yes. And it's not just someone who's drinking. It's the thing is, if I grow up in an alcoholic household, say, for example, and there's a lot of chaos and unpredictability, I'm going to have anxiety and fear. And my desire is going to be to control the people around me. Why? The delusion is, oh, I'm going to try to get them sober or control them because they need to get sober and I care about them. But really, it's because I want to feel better. I want relief. So that's the delusion. It's like,
is it a safety thing?
Of course. Yes.
Yeah.
It's all about safety. It's all about predictability and safety. And that's why many codependent people become over managers and we say control freaks. So I'm trying to control you because I'm feeling anxious and I can't tolerate what you're experiencing. And that's the worst thing about this codependency is that I'm treating people like they're not capable of being human, like they're not capable of tolerating a feeling or taking care of themselves or taking responsibility. And the thing about codependency and addiction is the consequences are so severe, meaning if I'm spending all my time trying to manage another person who doesn't want to get sober, I end up losing my own life. So I get depressed. I get anxious. I become enraged. I start having stomach problems. Like I'm the one that's holding everything. And meanwhile, they're just out drinking and don't want to get sober. So, you know, it affects both people negatively. And all the addict does is get angry. They don't want to be controlled. Now, I'm not saying we're completely powerless because we can set limits, we can express, geez, I need you to do this, or I'm going to do this. I mean, we could have a whole other episode on boundaries and how to communicate, but control is not going to work.
So I'm curious. I'm just trying to work this through in my own head. Probably.
Yes.
If you're subject to conditions and environment where you're younger, where you build the behaviors, the tendencies for sort of codependency.
Yes.
Does that actually in turn create, can that be more of an indication that drinking is going to likely create a problem later on down the line? And the reason I ask that, whether there's a correlation between codependency and developing a problem with alcohol, the reason I ask that is I talk so much about we reach for alcohol when we don't have our own needs met.
Yes.
We reach it when we feel a gap and, you know, an unfulfilled need. And I suppose if you've had years as a child and then a teenager managing environments where your needs haven't been met, they've always been relegated, I guess that that in itself can drive a predisposition to a bad alcohol relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a vicious cycle. If you're initially codependent, yeah, a natural thing would be to pick up alcohol because you're anxious, you're controlling, you're fearful, most likely you're resentful, most likely you have some pain. You know, you've ended up dismissing your own needs, so you're upset. So alcohol would be a natural kind of relief to all of that. And then what happens is, Anna, is then I put down the alcohol and guess what? The codependency is right there because it's never been resolved. So that's why I can be with a group of 20 people who all have over 25 years of sobriety. And what are they talking about? They're talking about why they can't speak up to their partners. They're talking about people-pleasing behavior. They're talking about resentments because they're not getting their needs met. It's all this underlying fear that's directing their behaviors and relationships that continue patterns. So I don't, you know, it's like I don't blame anyone or pathologize anyone. I really see it simply as you learned these behaviors as a kid to stay safe. You know, whether it was people pleaser, or maybe it was acting out, or maybe it was like getting angry so people would take the focus off of you. Maybe it was shutting down or denying or being seductive or whatever it is as a young person, as a teenager. So you do all these behaviors. This is what you learn. Yeah. So it's not like they're pathological. This is how I learned to get my needs met in a relationship. Gee, if I, you know, scream at my mother and she breaks down and finally gives in. Okay, I learned that's how it works. The problem is when we get sober and become adults, those old behaviors typically don't work anymore. People have a problem with it if I'm screaming at them. It may have worked when I was a child.
Yeah, I guess my mind's worrying a little bit because what your, not your lecturer, your the therapist in the room when you were back in college,
yep,
and you were telling your sort of situation whereby you were dating this guy, that's a classic situation where someone gets sober and immediately sort of pours themselves into fixing or saving someone else, okay, throwing them into a relationship, if you like, or being consumed by someone else's problems.
Yes.
And it sounds like that's a very typical place to land, but I guess there are other places you can land. It could be work or complete like hyper focus on achievement. So staying so busy that there's no room in life to feel anything.
Yes.
So what else can we hide, if you like?
Well, I'll tell you what is very common around here. People pick food. So in the first year, I gained 20 pounds in my first year. So very often people pick a substitution. So I may not be drinking anymore, but now I'm going to eat a bunch of sugar all the time. I'm going to start gaining weight. Other people like will be buying scratch tickets and gambling. Other people will definitely, many people get immediately into a relationship, especially a relationship with someone in the same situation. And now I'm going to, it's almost like I'm addicted to the person now. So now this person is going to be my focus rather than alcohol. So I'm just basically switching addictions or acting out sexually or working all the time and money. Shopping is huge. Amazon is huge. Yeah. I mean, it can be literally anything.
So the object changes, the focus changes, the function of that thing stays exactly the same. You're reaching for something outside of yourself to manage all the uncomfortable feelings internally. So it's almost just like you swap the vehicle. I've ditched alcohol. I'm picking up food or this relationship. Pennies just dropped. I'm so slow sometimes. Is this why AA counter that you don't go straight out into a relationship?
A relationship, right? Which nobody listens to.
No, but I did hear somewhere that is part of the advice, isn't it, in recovery?
Right.
Yeah.
Not to have a relationship in your first year. And really, a lot of it is because it's such a recipe for relapse, because so many people, it doesn't work out. And the pain of that loss is really hard to manage for a lot of people. I mean, and so often they'll just get into another relationship, but that pain, I've seen many people struggle with that in the first year. Oh, I should have listened to my sponsor because now my boyfriend broke up with me and I can't get out of bed. And again, it's all just, you know, I talk about kind of this delicate dance in those early years of recovery between going in and coming out. So it's like if you avoid feelings altogether, I believe it's a recipe for relapse. But if you dive in too quickly, too fast, and you're immediately like flooded with trauma memories, that's going to be a risk to relapse. So it's this very delicate dance in my first few years of like getting into therapy, diving in, going to some meetings, looking at myself, and then coming back, having fun, you know, distraction, you know, doing fun things. I remember going to movies all the time. Like I'm still a movie freak, but I remember on a Saturday one time, I went to 3 movies in one day because I just didn't know what to do with myself. And so, yeah, it's this going in and coming out and trying not to get too flooded with overwhelm. But I've seen many people stay sober for several years and then just the smallest thing happens and then they relapse because they've never really addressed anything.
I think it's a hugely important subject in that regard. I think it feels like it's not talked about enough. A lot of people, myself included to a degree, decided to, you know, look at and hopefully address my relationship with alcohol. And I did it largely on my own.
Yes.
Yes, I had support and I joined a program and I was walked through and motivated and stuff like that. But actually, no one was observing me.
Yes.
Just sort of go, ooh, ooh, red flag.
Yes.
You know, no one was seeing me obsessing over something else instead or compulsively, you know, working instead. So it's very much, I suppose, for people who do it on their own, it's on the individual to connect those dots. And actually, that just doesn't happen if you're head down obsessing about something new, does it? That's the ironic thing. It's not dots that you will necessarily connect on your own. I would imagine there's even a lot of even, you know, gray area drinkers who will recognize that they may have had months of not drinking, but just simply found themselves obsessing over something else or eating differently and just thinking, well, but not, you know, not connecting it to a pattern like this.
Well, and the thing is, and I don't know if we would disagree on this or not, but I definitely believe, and I think there are all kinds of alcoholics or problem drinkers. Mm. But for me, it really, the minute I picked up alcohol, I was obsessed and drank. And I do believe it's a mental illness. I mean, it's in the DSM as a mental illness. Maybe not everybody has that, but the thing about drinking that to me makes it lethal And why I take it super serious is because, and I think we talked about this, denial is the quintessential component, and denial is a cognitive concept. So the main component of my problem is mental. So it's like I'm trying to use the problem to solve the problem. And that to me can be very tricky. And so denial, rationalizing, minimizing, romanticizing, all these cognitions make it really hard to figure out on your own. I'm not saying it's impossible because people do it all the time, but you're really battling with those cognitive concepts. And so what happens is when you get sober, you may suddenly be out of denial and stop rationalizing your alcohol use, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to rationalize eating sugar all day or something else. So I still have this type of thinking, the obsessive compulsive thinking that's operating. And I can utilize that thinking in all kinds of ways, and it's still going to be dysfunctional. And I do believe addiction is a disease of isolation, and it does want to get you alone because it wants your mind. You know, there used to be an old joke where, you know, it said, I wake up in the morning and my mind is on the ceiling and it looks down and it says, I've been waiting for you to get up. Like that the alcoholic mind or whatever you want to call it is waiting to get in there and distress me in some way. And so it's tricky. And, you know, that's why I really like the mindfulness stuff and the Buddhism stuff and the, you know, spaciousness with your thinking and your thoughts, because 99% of my thoughts are just baloney. I mean, I can't believe my thinking. Yet that's what we did for years with our drinking. It's okay. I'll, you know, I stopped for a couple of days. I could drink tonight or whatever it's going to tell us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you started to sort of allude there to how, you know, certain practices, certain things might help. Let's talk about that for a bit, because I think there is a version of this conversation that can feel quite heavy. Like, you know, oh, great, I've just stopped drinking and now I've got to fix my entire relationship problems or, you know, this can feel difficult. So what does recovery, if that's the right term, from codependency actually look like? How does someone know when something's starting to shift?
So, you know, I just first want to say stopping drinking to me is the priority. I mean, the thing is, people die from alcoholism. And I've told you these stories, I think, that it's such a disease of rationalization that I've had many patients over the years. Someone might say, all right, I'm just going to drink at home. And then they fall down a flight of stairs and die. Or I just won't drink and drive. Or I just won't, you know. And the thing is, you can die from addiction in all kinds of ways. So stopping drinking to me is the first thing.
Not least of all, because if you are heavily drinking, you are not clear.
Absolutely not. Right.
In any
right.
way, state or in any way,
right.
People right. Form connected into what your own behavior looks like.
Yes. And I mean, I used to say, you know, in the old days, it was like, you know, they had these quizzes. And I'm telling you, I used to say this to people, and I still believe it. If you think to yourself, gee, I might have a problem with drinking, it's already too late. Mm-hmm. Like, that's already a sign, because most people who don't drink too much don't have those thoughts. Mm-hmm. They're not thinking I'm drinking too much. Mm-hmm. So, and the thing is, if you don't have a drinking problem, then what's the big issue with stopping for a couple of months and seeing what happens? Do you know what I mean? I mean, who is it? Andrew Huberman now. I mean, everybody's saying one drink a day is too much. So yeah. Who knows? But yeah, to get clarity, definitely the drinking and not drinking is huge. And if you have a substance abuse problem, not drinking for however long is huge. And it's and I guess I just would say it's very hard to do on your own, because it's an obsessive compulsive illness. So if you stop what often happens is the obsession increases. So I've had people say, well, I stopped and I'm only drinking on Friday nights. But the problem is, what are they doing Monday through Thursday? Obsessing about Friday night. So they're still not present.
So that would make you a very big advocate for what? Community of some sort?
Oh my gosh, really? Yeah. Connections.
Yeah.
Some type, whether it's your community or someone else, you need reality checks. And that's the thing about someone who's in denial, is what people do in interventions basically is they stick with facts. So if you're trying to figure out your own substance abuse problem, it's hard. And what they do in interventions are the family members don't talk about their feelings or their upsets. They cite facts. So they say, Dad, you forgot to pick me up 3 times that week at school, and I was really embarrassed in front of my friends. Or, you know, the wife says, you know, you've lost 3 jobs. I mean, those are facts. Mm-hmm. So people with substance abuse problems typically can't argue with facts. And so if you're trying to figure out something on myself, listing facts really helps, because facts break through denial. So your question was around getting sober and thinking, oh my gosh, I got to resolve all this stuff. And really, at first, it's literally just not drinking. And I do think it's having a lot of compassion for yourself, at the same time, responsibility, because in the responsibility is where the freedom lies. So I think people start dealing with codependency when they either start having relationship problems or they start noticing they're getting anxiety or depression or irritability or resentment or anger, one of those things, because those typically are manifestations of not addressing underlying issues.
Yeah, or unmet needs.
Yes, unmet needs. And also, I could be creating some of this, and that's where the codependency comes in. So say, for example, I can't ask for what I need because I'm afraid of my partner's response. So that's something that I've learned as a kid. I can't speak up. But the thing is, I'm creating it, because my partner might be totally willing to meet my needs, but for some reason, I'm afraid. So that's another thing. We have patterns of behavior, like a guy that I may have told you about, that, you know, a guy I know had a fear of abandonment, right? And so what did he do in relationships? He was controlling with his partners. And what would ultimately happen? He'd get abandoned. So it's a pattern over and over. I want to be in a relationship, but geez, I have this controlling behavior. And that's the other thing with codependency, is it's not, I look a lot at underlying fears, and it's not like fear of snakes or heights or whatever. We're talking about interpersonal fears that were developed growing up with our parents. So I'm talking about fear of abandonment, fear of rejection, fear mm-hmm. of someone else's opinion.
Fear of being too much.
Fear of not being good enough.
Yeah.
Fear of saying what, you know, that Al-Anon, say what you mean what you say, and don't say it mean, right? So fear of speaking up, fear of asking for what I need, fear of someone getting mad at me, fear of not being loved, not being liked. So there's all these interpersonal fears that get played out in codependent relationships. Because if I'm more focused on your feelings, I'm going to dismiss my own. And over time, if I dismiss myself for long enough, I'm going to become angry or anxious or depressed or act out in some way, have an affair, you know, whatever. It's going to come out somewhere.
100%. But I'm literally sitting here, Sarah, and I'm feeling so much pain for people who are in this situation, because I'm thinking, you know, how does it actually feel to start putting yourself back in the picture? Because if you're someone who spent years
yes.
organizing their entire life, their entire existence and deriving all of their value from other people.
Yes.
That must feel desperately unfamiliar to suddenly, you know, think I need to stop dismissing myself. In fact, I need to start putting myself first. You know, that choosing yourself.
Yes.
Is presumably incredibly hard and very uncomfortable to begin with. So there must be a heap of stuff that gets in the way of people doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, you're absolutely right. And that's why I can be in a room with people with 25 years of recovery still talking about it.
Yeah.
Because it's a real subtle thing. And I think, first of all, why I feel so strongly about this is I don't think people make the link between the anxiety, the depression, the whatever, need to have an affair, the, you know, the headaches, to codependency, to the dismissing the needs. I think if more people could see that they're highly correlated, we'd be much more apt to take action.
I think what's more common is I'm just thinking of like the common vernacular. You could be sat there going, I'm so angry, I'm so frustrated. They're just take. Actually, what's really going on is you're just give.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
And but the resentment that builds up, you can begin to feel so seething that you're not being seen, or you're not being taken seriously, or you're not. But in fact, it's, you know, unfortunately, it is a dynamic almost entirely of your own making in a way.
Well, and it's very similar. And that's why I really talk a lot about, in fact, this is interesting. When I went to that treatment center, I remember the guy putting on the whiteboard, alcoholics on one side. And it said something like 10% alcohol, 90% problems and pain and history and issues, right? And then on the other side, he put codependency. And he said 100%. Issues, pain. So it's like we both have the same issues. One is just, I got the alcohol on board, but it's really all the same stuff underneath. So to me, you know, whether you're recovering from alcoholism or not, or just codependency, it's really the same formula, which is this, which is beginning to learn how to tolerate discomfort. So the fact is, when I start getting into codependency recovery and I need to start learning how to speak up, I need to convince myself that this is going to benefit me, help me feel more freedom, less depressed, less angry. I have to actually really believe that all of these things are going to come true. It's like the promises of AA, same thing. There are going to be these promises from this recovery. And I always use the word freedom and liberation because it's so crazy when you think about it, Anna, because all we're asking people to do is this: tell the truth, right? Tell the truth to yourself.
To yourself.
And to someone else. So think about that. Honesty is a huge issue with addiction. And then we put down the booze and it becomes a huge issue in recovery, even though we don't even know we're being dishonest. Like I gave you that example with the dinner in the beginning. We don't even know we're lying to ourselves and the other person. And yet really we are. So the idea of I've got to learn to start tolerating new behaviors. And what I say to people is this: it's like, if you're going to struggle with doing it in your romantic relationship or with your parent, that's always another, with a parent or a child, do it in less threatening environments. So say you go to the coffee shop in the morning and they make your coffee wrong. See if you can speak up and ask for your coffee to be made, you know, in the way you want, rather than what we do is this. We get the coffee, we realize it's wrong, and we're like, oh, that's all right. They didn't mean it. But every time you do that, I want you to picture a hole in your body. And eventually, all you are is a piece of Swiss cheese. and you have so many holes in yourself, you no longer even know who you are. And that's what happens with people who are super codependent. You ask them a question and they'll answer for their partners, but they won't even know what they think, how they feel, or what they're doing.
So you absolutely, and what you're saying effectively is use low stakes environments.
Yes.
Like a cup of coffee, to make sure that you are expressing your needs and getting what you've asked for. I think often people can fall into a trap of thinking that those decisions to sort of not state their needs or speak up are quite benign, but they're not.
No.
They're not benign, because it's just another message to your brain.
Yes.
That you're not worth advocating for. That, you know, that you don't matter, your view doesn't matter. You'd rather that the bartender was having a nice morning than you got the coffee, which you've just paid $5 or, you know, £4 for. It's a complete relegation of self again, isn't it? Dismissing your needs in the most simple of situations, but it is not benign.
It's not benign. And that's such a brilliant thing to say, because just like we rationalize alcohol, oh, I'll just have one more. It's the same in codependency work. We can rationalize anything. So I can say, you know, I'm going to send you a copy of the book, and I'll send copies to anybody who wants one. But I have this thing in the book, and it says three things, and hopefully I'll remember them, that codependent people say are, one is, I don't care. Mm-hmm. Right? Another one is, I don't know. And I'll try to remember the other ones. But we have this way. Someone asks us a question and we say, I don't care. It's all right. And sometimes, yeah, we may not care what restaurant we're going to. But I would start practicing. When you notice you're going to say that, think to yourself, well, what if I did, and what would I say? Because maybe just caring about these little things will then generalize to the bigger things.
Yes.
And I don't care is this way of like trying to have someone not get upset with you because we think they're going to get upset if you express a need. I don't know is a way. And these are things that from seeing people for 30 years, I started to see patterns.
It's sitting on the fence, isn't it? I don't know is sitting on the fence. I don't know is, I don't know. I don't want you to be angry. I don't want you to have an opinion of my thoughts. So I'm just going to say nothing.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I don't know is also a way, God, this chokes me up for some reason, of someone saying, I don't want to know. I don't want to know what the truth is. It's like this thing where I'd have these clients, I'd say, geez, well, what do you think about, you know, your husband being this way for the last 6 months? He's been really angry at you and abusive. What do you think would be something that might be helpful? I don't know. Because if I don't know, I don't have to take an action step, right? The other one is I'm confused. I'm confused. Yeah, I'll tell you another one that people do a lot.
I don't know means I don't know what you want me to say. What yes. you want me to say.
Right. And the other one that people say lately that I've noticed a lot is it's complicated. When it's not complicated at all. Like I'll ask them a question about something in their relationship and they'll say, oh, it's complicated. All that is a defense, because you don't want to see the truth. And the thing is, I want people to know that you're in charge. You can make any decision you want. Just because, for example, you know that your husband's mean to you, for example, mm-hmm. you can still choose to stay in the marriage. That's up to you. I have no judgment about that. But it's almost like people have this fear that if I come out of confusion or I say the truth, then people are going to expect me to now do something. And the thing is, that's up to you. I mean, I knew cigarette smoking was going to cause cancer way before I stopped smoking cigarettes. I mean, it's you can know information, but there is, I think, a freedom in knowing your own truth, because I think it your shoulders can go down. There's some freedom in that.
I agree with that, and I say it over and over and over again to clients that, you know, for example, freedom for me, or liberation for me, isn't abstinence. It's awareness. It's awareness that allows you to then choose.
Yes.
Abstinence is the right thing, and, you know, liberation might not be leaving your husband, but it's being aware,
yes,
enough of the dynamics and its impact on you that you can make a choice,
yes,
that is based on what you feel, and honesty as, yes, to how you feel, rather than just shrinking.
Yes, and this is the kind of the two sides of the same coin, or they're different tracks. And going back to something you said earlier, I say on one hand, be compassionate for yourself, you know, try to get out of confusion and, you know, give yourself some space. At the same time, what you were saying before is, and what's so classic with alcoholics and codependency, is blaming other people. So I'm blaming you for my anger, and that's why I drink. In codependency, I'll scream and yell, but it's because you're still drinking. When it's really, I'm choosing the screaming and yelling. So until someone can say, I am responsible for my thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, which is the mantra of codependency recovery, it's hard to get freedom. I have to own, like you're saying, I have to be responsible for what I'm thinking, for what I'm feeling, and how I express it. I no longer, just like when I get sober, I give up the luxury of blaming someone else for my feelings. It's the same in codependency recovery. I can't blame you for me not expressing a need. You know what I'm saying? I can't say, yeah, oh, you didn't know I wanted. I've had clients, oh my God, Anna, the day after Mother's Day and birthdays, always huge, because people made up a story that their partners should know what they want. You know, it's like, and I'd say, well, did you ask them? Oh God, no. Oh no. They needed to know magically. And I would say, if you want X for your birthday, guess what? Ask for it. And so it's that same thing. It's like, you can pretend that everybody can read your mind, or you can be responsible. And that's why I always say there's freedom in the responsibility, because when you're in codependency, guess what you're doing? You're waiting for other people to change.
Yeah.
So you'll be happy. And guess what? That can go on for years and years and years and years.
Forever. Yeah.
Yes.
Also, I'm really conscious of time. I am sure that people are going to be listening to this and thinking, I think that could be me.
Yes.
Or recognizing bits of themselves in this conversation. Certainly, you know, it'll be floating thoughts, maybe moments of recognition, self-recognition, yes, to the surface. Let's close this down with the one thing that you'd want them to know.
Okay. I'm going to tell just a brief story about my best friend who, because this has to do with the first tool in recovery from codependency. So her husband relapsed and they went to therapy, and she was in the couple was in the therapist's office, and she kept asking the therapist, so what should Bill do? Should he get in a program? And then the person would, you know, look over at Bill and ask him a few questions. And then my friend would interrupt and start managing and asking, which is what codependent people do. And finally, the therapist just said, look, I need to talk to your husband a little bit, and worked out a program with him. And then at the end of the session, my friend says, well, what can I do? She said, you just need to rest, because The thing is, by the time someone comes into codependency recovery, they're over-functioning, they're exhausted, they're trying to control and manage everybody else's life. So the first thing I always say to people is, what can you get rid of? Maybe what can you let go of? Like a tiny thing, whether it's trying to do your kid's homework for him, or trying to manage your husband's working out program, or whatever it is. Like, try to think of one thing you can cut back on, or one thing you can just add for yourself. So if it's a half an hour during the day to take a walk, or if it's a half an hour to sit on the couch and do nothing, codependent people are usually over-functioning and enraged. And there's a flip side to that, or they're people pleasing and they're nice to everybody. And we could talk about all the presentations another time, but taking some time for yourself initially is going to be, you know, a step in the right direction. Two other quick steps would be, I would say, think of one action step you can take around doing something for you. It's similar, but whether it's speaking up to somebody, like I know friends of mine, you know, like getting off a school committee you don't even want to be on. Like, clarify, what am I doing in my life that I think I have to when I don't? I'm just doing it out of a fear of what people are going to think about me.
It's a bit of an audit, really, isn't it? To look at all the time-sapping things that you are involved in and ask, why am I doing this?
Yes.
Why am I doing this? And do I even want to do it?
Yes.
Well, Sarah, this has been such a rich conversation. Thank you. Thank you for your honesty.
So good.
Candor, which you characteristically bring. I love it. For anyone who wants to find you, I'm going to put the links into the show notes. I know Leaving Crazy Town on YouTube is probably the best source of getting more of Sarah. It's brilliant. It's warm. It's funny. The work you do there with Finn is excellent. So thank you so much. And for anyone listening to this who feels a little bit stirred by stuff that we've talked about today, if anyone's felt that this is a little bit too familiar, I would genuinely encourage you not to just scroll past that feeling and to sit with it and just to really dig in with some of the thoughts that Sarah's raised here today, because that is exactly where the work starts and exactly what this show is here for. So thank you very much, Aidan. Until next time, thank you, Sarah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Brilliant.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.